I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. This is episode 7 and the conclusion of our series on Estée Lauder versus L'Oreal. These two giants have dominated the makeup and beauty industry for more than 50 years. During their reign, consumers gravitated toward their high-end legacy products, and they were willing to pay big bucks for the brand name. But now we're seeing a new wave of competitors challenging these titans of industry. Smaller brands that are getting attention from the tastemakers of the 21st century, beauty influencers. So what's driving the shift from big name to boutique brands? And how will a historically white industry adapt to a new generation of consumers hungry for diversity? For more, I'm chatting with Arabelle Sicardi. Sicardi has written about the beauty industry for over a decade, working as an editor, strategist, and trend forecaster. They're currently writing a book about beauty and political power, The House of Beauty. We'll discuss the future prospects of the makeup industry and how L'Oreal and Estée Lauder may well be relics of the past. All that is coming up next.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. Arabelle Sicardi, welcome to Business Wars.
It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Let's begin by talking about these two players that both sort of have humble origin stories, both L'Oreal and Estée Lauder, going on to become establishment brands that, well, by and large, shaped the future of makeup and beauty, at least as we've known it for many years. But in recent years, we're seeing some new players enter the market. Tell us a little bit more about some of the brands that you've noticed and what seems to be going on now in the industry.
Well, there's been a huge rise of the direct-to-consumer brand, we'll acronym them DTC. So you have a rise of not only direct-to-consumer brands, but brands run by and founded by women of color, which I think is a really welcome change in the industry and something that's been a long time coming.
This is really interesting because the landscape, the sort of the playing field in a sense, for how cosmetics and beauty items and brands are marketed, it's really sort of turned upside down. I mean, once upon a time, it was word of mouth. So I guess in a way, we're sort of going back to the future, aren't we? I mean, because they're marketing to individuals who will spread the word, and it sort of builds up sort of from the ground up, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, actually. It's been really interesting to see the priorities of consumers so rapidly change. I mean, we've seen in the last year in the pandemic that in-person retail is not really a thing anymore, and people are buying more and more online. And rather than going to specific retailers, they may be most influenced by TikTok influencers themselves or going directly to brands often through Instagram and other social media platforms. So the way that people are shopping is rapidly changing, and you can already see that reflected in the numbers for big brands and small brands. When you would expect that everyone would be suffering in the pandemic, they've still been able to turn a profit and grow.
Question is, though, with so many influencers, how does a brand like Estee Lauder or L'Oreal remain relevant, especially when it's hard to know which influencer is going to work best for the brand? How do you pick out your influencers, I suppose, is what I'm asking if you're a company like Estee Lauder or L'Oreal.
That is a very good and expensive question that people get paid just to navigate. And a lot of the times they do subcontract that outreach.
Really?
To social media agencies. I've been outreached to brands as an influencer through a middle person as well as through brands directly. So it's really about figuring out how you want to do it, if you want to have a dedicated department.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a large brand to do that, or if you're going to do the outreach for it.
So we have customers that are pushing the envelope when it comes to the future of the industry. You have shifting sensibilities in the culture. You have growing awareness of the impact that these companies have on our culture and on the environment and on society at large. You have a youth generation, which is obviously critical to an industry like beauty. But ultimately, success is often gauged by the numbers, right? I mean, how's business, in a sense? How do you track who the winners and losers are on this new playing field?
Well, it's lucky that since L'Oreal and Estee Lauder are actually on the stock market, You can actually monitor their success. And their annual reports are pretty transparent about what categories are succeeding for them and which ones are falling. And the L'Oreal senior management has said they were losing a percentage of their profits to what they called local players, which is to say direct-to-consumer brands and brands that weren't their initial competition, that weren't part of like the big three conglomerates that we know of. And it's only gotten more of a struggle for the main conglomerates to retain power, which is why they've also been ramping up their acquisitions in the past couple years. And ultimately, the competition between Revlon and Estee Lauder is really about who can they acquire that will maximize their growth the fastest and for the longest term.
I assume L'Oreal and Lauder are still giants in the field. But I'm curious, is there any way of knowing authoritatively, of course, which of these smaller brands pose the greatest threat to some of the giants?
Honestly, it's really hard because a lot of the analytics firms and a lot of these ways in which reporters, at least, are able to gauge the numbers, they don't always include direct-to-consumer brands in those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not publicly traded, so we can't know how well they're doing unless they release that information. And they're far more likely to create a narrative of high demand and also scarcity to help create a valuation and create hype so that their business does increase in profits and so they become more valuable. But I can't even say accurately how well these companies are doing unless they're in a conversation to get venture capital funding. Like, we know the valuation of Glossier, which is a very important small brand, but a smaller brand in comparison, because they have gone through rounds of VC funding and they have gotten numbers calculated that represents how much money they're valued for. You know, if a company is stocked at Walmart or Target or Sephora or Ulta, their profits from going from an online-only store to a big box retailer product, it can increase their revenues by like 200% if they can, or more if they can scale up properly.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no onus on them to release their numbers to the public the way there's an onus for L'Oreal and Estee to do so, because those are publicly traded companies And if you have any investment in them whatsoever, you are obligated to that knowledge.
If this is actually making beauty more accessible to consumers, or if you're talking about brands that are most accessible to everyday folks, you're talking about, still, aren't you, the Walmarts of this world or the CVS drugstores of this world, where people, you need something, you're going to go and hit it, and it's going to be inexpensive, right?
Exactly. And we've seen huge brands completely pivot their retail strategy in the past 6 or 8 months to try and get back into the drugstore or into Target, because these places are categorized as essential businesses in a way that, say, like a department store, which would obviously stock high-end luxury brands, mm-hmm. they're not open, and people aren't shopping for that stuff, but they're going to be shopping for toilet paper, and they're going to pick up a mascara along the way if it's there, because it'll make them feel better. So a lot of brands are trying to get into this mass market space, not only because there's way more money to be made, because there's more consumers that can afford that than, you know, a $50 foundation, but it's also because that's where they're going to live their lives.
Even though there's been such change in the industry, it sounds like basically the real battles are to get into those spaces where there's a mass distribution model and also costs are limited. We're not talking about hugely expensive products here. We're not, you know, exclusivity used to be part of the selling proposition for some of these beauty products. But if you're talking about increasing accessibility, you've got to keep the price low and you've got to have it in a place where it's going to be available.
Yeah. And the rise of small brands has been skyrocketing because a lot of the most popular ones, for example, The Ordinary, their entire marketing strategy is to be accessible and transparent with a very educated consumer. So the rise of The Ordinary, it happened in like 3 to 4 years, I would say. People that love using Reddit for skincare advice, they hyped up this product line, and it spread on the internet, and it ended up being stocked in drugstores rather than, you know, just being a mid-range or high-end experience. You can get really high-quality exfoliants and serums and like specialty skincare products mm-hmm. at like $10 as opposed to, you know, $70.
Right.
So that made everyone freak out, and it completely upended the market, because now you have really strong competitions from dupes. Whereas before, you had comparable products, but you may not have been able to get them necessarily at CVS mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. other drugstore locations.
Right, right.
So it drove the demand for cheaper products to a point where people had to change their marketing strategies and come up with new ways to sell their products.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. We get support from Acura. The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Well, while we're talking about the accessibility of the beauty industry, that also extends to diversity. And the standard of beauty, and by extension, the whole beauty industry, has been rather narrow for decades. I mean, it's been a very white industry for a long time. And we've seen the effects of that, of course. Limited shades of foundation for people of color, beauty products geared toward black women being locked up at stores. I mean, this is stuff that's happened, and it's been a part of that the story of the industry. Did you notice this lack of inclusion in the beauty industry growing up as a person of color?
Oh, definitely. And my rage at it is part of why I started writing about beauty. And it's still the foundation of why I find beauty interesting, because it can be hard for people to articulate politics, and people can get frustrated about not knowing the right words or not knowing enough about theory and stuff like that. But everyone has feelings about their body and how people perceive it. Everyone has an investment in figuring out ways to be safer in a public space or to be more desirable in a public space and how that shapes our lives. So everyone's invested in beauty in a political way. That's exactly why I still love the industry and I'm interested in it, because it's so tied to everything else in the world.
That's interesting, because you've been working on this for 10 years now. Over this course of the 10 years, would you say the industry has changed in a big way, or is it just the marketing of the industry that seems to have changed?
I mean, 10 years is a long time. I would say that it has had really significant changes, and a lot of those significant changes have happened just in the last 2 years. You have players like Uoma Beauty coming out. You have the rise of Pat McGrath and her impeccable line of beauty products. And you have more founders of beauty brands that are people of color. And, you know, Rihanna, she changed the game in a lot of ways. The Fenty effect, it reshaped what customers expected and demanded of the industry, and it legitimized investing in a bigger shade range because the numbers proved out. There's an example of Lancôme. Mm-hmm. They had Lupita Nyong'o as their spokesperson, but they had to invent a new shade for her for the campaign because they didn't have a shade dark enough initially. Wow. In their line.
Uh-huh.
And they had their black chemist work on the shade range. She wasn't initially given the resources she needed to create this product, but then she did, and then it became a spin of inclusivity. But it kind of put the cart before the horse, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, they should have already had that.
Right. Do you think that when you get to the boardroom level, though, that these brands are really interested in creating this sort of inclusivity, diversity, and equity that a lot of their customers seem to be calling for? I mean, it's one that you can provide lip service, you can create the optics, right? But what is your sense about what's happening actually in the boardrooms of some of these, especially larger players in the cosmetics and beauty industry?
Well, I think that we have to see what they do on a long-term basis. And from knowing the history of these brands, I am not expecting revolutionary changes immediately.
You're not?
I'm not. I think that it's not enough to hire, you know, more people of color throughout a retail environment. It matters if you choose a person of color to lead at a senior level and a person of color to be management. There is still a ceiling for Black, Latina, and like Asian women in these spaces. And donating a couple of million dollars to a non-political entity isn't the same thing as creating a space where your workers, from your retail employees to your senior management and your CEOs, but ultimately the people that aren't powerful, to feel safe enough to offer critique and to help create the change that they need to see happen and to feel safe and supported in that change. So they have to create and dismantle an environment at the same time. And that's hard work. So do I think that there's going to be you know, revolutionary change in the next 6 months or a year? Not necessarily. Do I think that incremental change is happening and that these companies, the people within them, are capable of surprising me and proving me wrong? I think that too.
Well, in a better or a more perfect world, what would diversity and equity actually look like? Paint that picture, if you would. What is a more diverse, more equitable, in fact, an ideal situation look like for the cosmetics and beauty industry as you see it?
Well, there would be far more Black, Asian, Latina founders on these huge successful lists. There would be more money and network and power dedicated to people that have been marginalized their entire lives. They're given more shelf space at these big box stores and in luxury markets. There's not only more diversity and authentic storytelling in campaigns, but the people that are part of creating those campaigns are also diverse and also have equity in the community, because it's not enough to just cast someone. You have to have people part of the process from the very beginning. More dermatologists of color, more estheticians of color, more cosmetic chemists of color. We would have more systematic change in who gets represented, who products can be for, and what the stories of those products can look like. So there needs to be more of those opportunities and investment and less virtue signaling about understanding people's pain, because we may never understand each other's pain, but we can hold space for that. So more shelf space, more diversity of brands and offerings. And that's not just brands for or founded by marginalized people. It's also the accessibility of the packaging, so people of different physical capabilities can participate in the beauty industry, because the disabled community isn't really spoken to or considered in beauty marketing or beauty products at all, and they're incredibly underserved.
Arabelle, you've also had jobs as a trend forecaster. I know crystal balls can sometimes be a little cloudy. What trends can you forecast about makeup, skincare, the parts of the industry that we've been talking about? I mean, how do you see it coming together in, let's say, a timetable of the next, oh, I don't know, 5 years? Where do you see it?
Well, I think we're still going to be dealing with the effects of the pandemic reshaping.
Really?
Not only the supply chain, but retail spaces and the product categories that are popular. There may be rapid switchbacks when we're living in a post-vaccine world, but for now, we're going to see a lot of investment and interest in the skincare market and in products like mascara and skincare tools and nails and more things that you can do at home, like at-home beauty treatments, because most people are not going into salon spaces or spas right now, and they won't be for a while. So we're going to see that reflected in the trends, and that's going to be true, I think, for the next 2 years. Now, makeup will probably come back with a complete vengeance in 3 years, but I think it has a lot to do with how we're going to be dealing with wearing masks in the future. The reason why false eyelashes and mascara and brow gel are doing really good as product categories for brands is because those are the things that people are still wearing when they go outside.
Right.
That's going to be true until that's not the only option anymore. And then we'll see a big change.
That's it's interesting that you would say that, you know, years from now, we're still going to be talking about the pandemic, especially in this industry. Are you optimistic about overall the progress of the beauty industry in the long term?
I would say so. You know, the trends in beauty, they change really rapidly. And you're right. The beauty industry did really pivot really well and really quickly when it came to dealing with the pandemic. And that's because the ingredients necessary to deal with the pandemic are also part of just the basics of beauty products themselves. The reason why there's so many different hand sanitizers and, you know, scented lotions and stuff and soaps, and they all sell well. Like, that's been a boon to the industry, actually. And it just required, you know, some modifications at the factory. It didn't require modifications to actual products. They just decided to stop making as much and to focus more on sanitizers because they use a lot of the same ingredients as perfumes. So was it a huge pivot? Not necessarily. Was it still really remarkable and impressive and useful? That's also true. So they may pivot again really quickly.
Arabelle Sicardi, they're currently writing a book about beauty and political power, The House of Beauty. Sicardi's written about the beauty industry for over a decade, working as an editor, strategist, and clearly trend forecaster. Arabelle, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on Business Wars. It's been a real pleasure.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is episode 7 of L'Oreal versus Estée Lauder for Business Wars. I'm your host, David Brown. Lori Galloretta produced this episode. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound designed by Kyle Randall. Our associate producer is Kate Young. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.